You are listening to Investing Matters, brought to you in association with London South East. This is the show that provides informative, educational, and entertaining content from the world of investing. We do not give advice, so please do your own research.
Hello, and welcome to this Investing Matters podcast. My name is Peter Higgins. You can find me at Conquest3 on Twitter. And today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Jay Younger, the Aubrey Capital European Investment Analyst and Manager of the Aubrey Capital AIM Portfolio. Jay is an investment analyst and he joined Aubrey Capital in 2018 and is previously an investment analyst focusing on European small cap equities. Jay, welcome to the Investing Matters podcast, mate.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Pete. Appreciate it.
No, you're welcome, sir. I'm absolutely thrilled to have you on, actually, because having met you at the Master Investor Show, and then you absolutely smashed it on that particular panel, I was like, yeah, let's get this on. I'll have a full interview with Jay and find out a bit more about him. So yeah, thank you, mate.
No, not at all. Appreciate the invite. Thanks a lot for having me.
Cool. Right. We're going to start this Investing Matters podcast, Jay, going all the way back to some things, because I like to find out stuff about individuals that others don't know and talk about the whole journey, because that's the most important thing that makes you unique to everybody else that's out there in the investment industry. So I'm going to start this with initial interest potentially in becoming the Alan Wells of Scotland, right, for the 400 meter sprint category, right? So you're an outstanding athlete, yeah, and you won a prestigious sports scholarship to study sports science and chemistry, and you went to Loughborough University, yeah? Regularly recognised as the best university in the world for sports-related subjects. Tell us a little bit about that episode, what happened and why that didn't go as planned, as often is the case with athletes.
Yeah, so I went, as you say, I went to Loughborough University on a sports scholarship. My discipline was 400 metres flat. And at the time, I'd just been sponsored, well, if you like, to the Commonwealth Games in 2014. And it was a really exciting time in my life. I kind of thought that I was going to be off the back of just having Olympic, because London 2012 had just happened. I just had my Olympic trials as a 17-year-old. I didn't make the Olympic team, but I knew I wasn't going to make it, but it was more just for the experience to potentially make Rio in 2016. And then we went to Loughborough University with high hopes. And I just fell out of love with the sport. It's sad to say, but I think as a spectator looking in, there's a lot of things that you don't see. And it was quite a tough lifestyle to live. My good mate, Jake Whiteman, who I went down with, he became world champion just last year in Eugene. So it's really interesting. You've got two case studies of a guy going down to Loughborough, making it, becoming world champion, and myself who bowed out after 6 months. But it was an incredible journey and I learned a lot. And I feel like the work ethic that I learned as an athlete, I tried to apply that to my day-to-day work as well now.
Brilliant. No, thank you for sharing that. I think it's very important that we learn from our challenges, don't we? You know, and that's what makes us stronger and stronger. So Jay, I want to go on now and talk about what triggered your interest in investments and finance, leading up to your initial fledgling role, answering calls about pensions, right? And then 8 months contract with Baillie Gifford, which is a bit more prestigious, I must say. And can you tell us how you then utilize that time as well to self-fund yourself in gaining your investment operations certificate and the investment management certificate as well at the same time?
Yeah, so my first job in financial services, I got through a recruiter when I left Loughborough. I was originally cleaning golf clubs at a golf club in Scotland. And I got a job in financial services, and it was as a customer service representative at a pension provider called Aegon. And my job was to answer calls about people's pensions. And a lot of the questions I was getting asked, I didn't understand. So the most frequent one I got was, why is the value of my pension changing all the time? And I didn't really understand that myself. And when I was trying to give information back as a 19-year-old at the time, I wasn't giving very comprehensive answers. So I took it upon myself to actually take an interest into why is this happening. And the more I read about it, I discovered the world of investing, and I discovered how people allocate capital to asset classes in order to grow their wealth for retirement. And then I wanted to do one better than working at Aegon, where I was only paid £13,500 as my first salary. And so I got a job with Baillie Gifford as an administrative assistant. And even though I was basically photocopying and scanning loads of papers for the trades that the fund managers had done, but I was right at the back of the office, it opened my eyes into how you actually become an investment analyst. And it was during that time where I saw the graduates doing their professional qualifications. So they were studying for the IOC, the Investment Operations Certificate, the Investment Management Certificate, and CFA. So I just took it upon myself. I asked Baillie Gifford at the time, I said, can you pay for my exams? But because I was only on a contract that was going to run, as you say, after 8 months, they were like, no. So I just paid for it myself. I just thought, why not? I went for it. And then, yeah, I reapplied to university to study economics and finance at Heriot Watt. So I was a bit late going into university. I was 21 at this time. And I started studying from a CFA level one at university. And then, yeah, just kept going.
I think you're not saying enough there for me, Jay. Let me just expand on this. So you then decided, I'm going to go back to uni. You commenced your academic studies at Heriot Watt University to study economics and finance at 21. And then you went on to get a first class honours degree, as well as doing your other CFA level one and two. So that's not hang about here, mate. That's pretty darn good to do all that, because you're like, I now know what I want to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're back sprinting again now. Yeah, you're exactly. Doing a degree and you're doing your CFAs at the same time. You're like, I'm on it.
Exactly. I mean, I was pretty lucky in the sense that I had a good network around me. So I'm not sure if you know a name, Colin McLean. He founded SVM, Scottish Value Management.
Oh, I know him, yeah.
Yeah, so Colin, I'm very good mates with his son. Him and I are very good mates just through school. And Nathan, his name is a legend. And Colin helped me, if you like, visualize where I wanted to go, and he helped me get to my final destination. He helped me craft the path. And when I was speaking to him about when I was at Baillie Gifford, he said the quickest way for you to become an investment analyst, if this is what you have to do, is to return to university to study economics and finance as a chosen degree. And then if you can, do your CFA. And once I knew the formula, it was just, like you say, a simple case of just work hard. It was just like athletics. If you tell me the time I want to run and we plan the sessions in advance, all I need to do is just run the sessions, and providing you stay injury free and you keep your head down, you should get there. And that's
brilliant
what we did.
Advice from Colin McLean there. Brilliant advice from him. Well done. And yeah. and you took the advice. Other people will hear that advice and not do anything about it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I remember my first lecture in economics. I went directly into second year, I should add. I managed to persuade Heriot Watt University to add me, even though I didn't study A-level maths or economics at at school. I said, let me go in directly into second year. And I remember my first lecture, I actually had to get a tutor for my first semester at Heriot Watt, because I didn't understand how to do differentiation, integration, just basic algebra. I didn't know how to do it. So I was like, okay, this is going to be a tough learning curve, but I'm going to have to jump right in.
Wow. Kudos to you, mate. Very well done. You stuck it and you went out and smashed it and got a first class honours degree. So very well done. So let's talk now about your first role after graduating. Kempen Capital Management as a junior investment analyst. So you've got through the graduation, you've got through the process, you get your first job, and you're an analyst focusing on the European small cap equities. Please share with us that role as a junior and the insights you gained from it as well.
Yeah, I would say I was incredibly lucky. Again, that was through a recruiter how I got that job. And that was my first job, as you say, in the industry. And I feel incredibly lucky to have it. And I'm sure my ex-colleagues at Kempen wouldn't mind me saying this, because they'll all agree with how it ended. It taught me exactly what not to do. And I don't mean that in a bitter way. It's just because, sadly, the two funds were shut down due to poor performance. And as an investment analyst, a junior investment analyst at the time, it taught me exactly what not to do. And what I mean by that is that I think a lot of fund managers and analysts can become obsessed with financial modeling, and they can scrutinize historical annual reports, accounts, etc., to try and build a target price, when really that target price is just a function of the inputs that you've just told the model to tell you. So it's only as good as your assumptions that you tell it. And I think that what that job taught me was it's really important to have a good grasp of valuation and not to overpay for a stock. And that's what that job taught me the most. And when sadly it went bust and I was made redundant after after a year there, despite finally getting CFA after getting through all those exams, you know, I thought, oh great, I can now coast a bit. But no, I lost my job and I found myself back on the labor market after a year of after graduating. But yeah, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything, because as I say, it really taught me about how things can go wrong and what not to do.
Brilliant. No, that's a life solid journey and a lesson to be learned, mate, every step of the way. Now, there is a story behind this. I want you to share it. How you gained your initial role at Aubrey Capital, how that came about. Because to me, that's just like a bit of serendipity going around here.
Yeah, again, I was lucky that I Sharon Bentley Hamlin is the lead fund manager of the European strategy at Aubrey Capital Management, and as you know, her track record is phenomenal. I mean, up until 2021, the fund was the top percentile in Europe over 3, 5, and 10 years. And I first met Sharon at a lunch. We were both just happened to be seeing a company. It's a Dutch company, a property company called PPH. I remember it, and I met Sharon, but obviously it was in the summer of when I was at Kempen, so I didn't action anything. But then when I was looking, I remember thinking, I met Sharon at a meeting. I really took an interest into the questions that she was asking. It wasn't so much the orthodox questions that I was supposedly thought were good questions. They were different. So I sent Sharon an email and I said, please, can you interview me? I think at Aubrey you're missing the trick with sustainability and ESG, because I forgot to mention at Kempen I'd come from a SRI background, so the funds, the although it was European small cap equities, there was a strong focus on ESG. So a lot of the ESG analysis that we did for the companies at Kempen, I thought Aubrey could benefit from the European side at least. So Sharon interviewed me, and it was quite a quick turnaround process. I went through 4 interviews, I think, at Aubrey, and then November 2018 I started. Yeah, and 5 years later, I'm still here.
Absolutely phenomenal. So I want to talk now about that. Those not even 5 years yet, going on to 5 years in November of this year. What you've done, what you've achieved, and how you've gone about it, because you. I'm using this theme, and people are going to hate me saying this over and over again. You're on a sprint here, Jay. You're like, you know.
Yeah, so I mean, this is probably going to be a bit controversial of me to say, but when I joined Aubrey Capital Management, I was still doubtful about how efficient markets were, and I was still of the belief that really passive management will become the norm, because I didn't have an experience before at Kempen where I saw us actually outperforming the market consistently. Like, yeah, sure, we might beat the market on a 1 month, but then the second month, the third month, we were underperforming. And it just seemed to me that these markets are all efficient. Surely active management doesn't actually work. And then at Aubrey Capital Management, I generally saw firsthand us outperforming the market month on month. And between the years of 2019, 2020, and 2021, I couldn't believe the returns that we were generating. I mean, the first 2019, we had an absolute return of 45%. 2021, it was 27%. And then 2022, it was 22%, all of which we smashed the benchmark. And for me, in my career growing up, I realized we can actually make money here. You can actually make money with good research and a good investment philosophy. And that's what really opened my eyes, Aubrey. When Sharon has taken me under her wing, and I'm hugely grateful for her. And you know, I see her more as a mentor than a boss, because she's actually helped me develop, not just on an analytical level, but on a personal level too. And I feel that that's what Aubrey has really taught me, how to beat the market. And I I think I can say fairly confident now. I've got the recipe to do it.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think it's really important to have a good mentor and a good individual to look up to as a role model who's actually doing the doing, not just doing the talk. You know, and she's
exactly.
one of the best female fund managers out there. So you've got a fantastic coach and mentor to have, mate. So well done. Now, yeah. I want to talk about giving me a little bit of an overview, but also what differentiates Aubrey. You've touched on it a little bit there with the ESG side of it and looking at quality companies. How do they differentiate from the other fund management companies out there?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, other than if we don't want to go too technical just now, we can go technical, but I think the biggest thing about Aubrey is that there's no bureaucracy in the company at all. So I'd say if we have an investment idea or we have an investment decision to implement, we don't need to jump through X amount of committees to get that decision over the line. We can get it done literally in that minute. So if we're managing the money and we see a valuation opportunity after having done our research, we're straight in to buy it. We don't need to consult X amount of people about what we're doing. And I feel like having come from that, from an investment banking side at Kempen, to seeing that at Aubrey, that speed is a big competitive advantage, I'd say, that we have over other houses.
Fantastic. I didn't know that. That's really, really good. Now, you've talked about the competitive advantage. Talk to me now about the investment strategy, which you touched on a little bit when we were at Master Investor Show. The investment strategy for Aubrey Capital, please, Jay.
Yeah, so the investment strategy at Aubrey Capital is based on what we like to call the 315s and not overpaying for earnings growth. So the 315 stands for we only invest in companies which have the ability to grow their earnings year on year at 15%. We only invest in companies which, this is probably the most important plank, the companies that can self-finance that earnings per share growth, so what we call the cash flow return on assets of 15% per annum. And then finally, they have to have a return on equity of 15% per annum too. If a company can fulfill all these 315 hurdles, then the final component is the price to earnings ratio divided by the earnings per share growth. And we won't pay anything over 1.5 times for the companies that we invest in. And I think that why Aubrey is so good is that if you can find companies which are growing at 15% per annum and you're paying a reasonable valuation for that growth, it's almost like companies acquiring other companies in that terms of that IRR, like payback. It's like project management where you're getting that return on the investment. That's what we're looking for and some. And it's that the ability to self-finance the earnings per share growth is the key. I mean, the reason why 15 is the important part. I mean, I spoke about this in the talk that we did, Pete, earlier in this month, where if you think about it, historical performance of equities have returned a real rate of return of around about 5%. Typically, you have to then add on an adjustment factor for inflation, and that can be anywhere from 3 to 5%. So let's round up there if you call it 8 to 10. Then you have to take into the humble. Then you need to take into account that as us active managers, in order for us to justify our existence, we need to beat the benchmark by, let's say, 2%. So then if you add 2% to the range of 8 to 10, you're going to get somewhere between 10 to 12%. And then you need to take into the humble truth that as active managers, we don't always get our decisions right. So if you divide 10 or 12% by 70%, de facto, you get around about 15%. And that's why we do it. And that's why when we invest in companies, 15% is the minimum that we're looking for in order for us to invest.
And that's probably why across the benchmark, you're beating most companies.
Yeah, I mean, last year, again, I've been learning a lot. And last year was a massive learning curve for me, again, because 2022 was a really tough year for Aubrey. Not just for Aubrey, I think it was really tough for any growth manager. And I think given the way that the types of companies that we invest in, most of those companies, because I should say we're bottom-up investors. And what that means is that we don't let the macro dictate where we pick our companies. We like to, if we see a good company, we're agnostic to the benchmark or we're indifferent to which sector it's operating in. If that company is performing well, we're going to buy the shares. And I think last year, because we had quite a lot of exposure to the information technology sector, the derating that happened was a big wake-up call for me and a big learning curve for me, because I'd never experienced that. I never experienced a time where you have a company which is growing its underlying earnings growth at 89%, which we had in the portfolio, and yet shares are off year to date down 50%. It was a very confusing and difficult time to manage money.
Yeah, it happens, and like you say, but the beauty of it is that the quality of the company and the revenues of the companies is improving. It's the market underlying that's changed. So that's about the consistency, which we're going to touch on a bit later. I want to touch on a little bit there about your qualifications and go back about the importance, because one of the things that triggered you to contact and speak with Sharon was about the ESG angle, and that's embedded within Aubrey Capital. So please, can you share with us the ESG criteria and how that's integrated into investments and why it's so important for Aubrey Capital?
Yeah, so at Aubrey Capital Management, we designed our own in-house ESG framework. So we divided our ESG questionnaire into E, S, and G, each section equally weighted between the environment, social, and governance. And there's 29 questions in total, which we do. And where we focus our ESG analysis on is on the material risks of the companies. So, for example, if we're investing in a heavy manufacturer, we're going to be more interested in their health and safety policies as we are opposed to their data and cybersecurity policies. Or if we're investing in a company which deals with a lot of customer data, we're going to be more interested in their data and cybersecurity policies as we are their health and safety policies. Not saying that we wouldn't pay attention to health and safety policies, it's just that's the material pressing risk. I think at Aubrey, we take a common sense and pragmatic approach to ESG management. It's not, we don't like to attribute or discount value, like a premium or discount to the valuation of a company because we think that it has good ESG or poor ESG. It's more the fact that we like to have frequent dialogue with management and try and understand, okay, just because they might not have published certain policies or regulatory certificates around a certain ESG topic, that doesn't necessarily mean they've got poor ESG. It just might mean that they've not got the budget to dedicate to disclosing certain policies. And that's why I'd say, going back to a key competitive advantage at Aubrey, is that having the ability to speak to management is a big benefit to us. That corporate access is very important.
Brilliant. Love that response. Thank you. Now, Jay, you've touched on it there slightly prior to the question prior. When you look at some of the really good results of your portfolio holdings of late, and you've been struck by the irrational reaction and often inconsistent reaction of the share price movement, what in your view is happening in the investing arena at the moment regarding some fundamentals?
Yeah, I think that at the moment there's a lot of variables which are affecting the share prices, and it's not necessarily due to the fundamental performance of the underlying companies, rather to do with more sentiment driven. I mean, the obvious factor is the concerns around inflation and interest rate rising. If you can hold now in the bank, if you're getting 5% risk free, then it's quite tempting to just keep your money in the bank and not invest in the stock market, because at the stock market, you're taking on a risk, whereas in the bank, there's no risk and you're getting 5%. So I think that's probably one of the biggest variables. I also think that one of the most concerning, but it's more the fact that just investor nervousness around the uncertainty around this rate cycle. I think as soon as the rate cycle starts to turn, I do expect there to be a big bounce in equities, particularly equities which are characterized by more growth characteristics, because these have been derated so hard, particularly in 2022. They're due a re-rating. I mean, there's some companies in the portfolio, there's one I spoke about just there, its underlying earnings per share growth 89%, but year-to-date shares are down 50%. I mean, to me, that's not rational. So I think we are due to see a big re-rating. But yeah, I mean, long story short, I would just say I think there's a degree of risk aversion that's not subsided yet. And I think until the rate cycle starts to ease or alleviate, then we should see money start to flow back into equities.
No, I appreciate that reply. Thank you. Thank you ever so much for that, Jay. I'm going to touch now, we talked about interest rates, but also another factor impacting the markets, or appears to be, is inflation, Jay, yeah? It seems that the market's trying its level best to move on from the inflation question. The debate's been raging for nearly 2 years now. Less than 2 years ago, notably, economists and central banks were saying rising inflation was transitory. Less than 6 months ago, it's saying it peaked. Now they're saying it's possibly sticky. How do Horbury Capital just wade through all of this noise on inflation to pick the best quality European and UK stocks?
Yeah, so with regards to the inflation, you're right. It's so inconsistent, the narrative, and the numbers are saying one thing and the narrative is saying the other thing. But I think when you're in a high inflation environment, it's really important to pick companies which have high gross margins or high margins in general. And the reason for that is because it demonstrates that the companies have a high ability to pass through any cost inflation which they might be experiencing. So last year, well, Q3 of last year, that was probably the peak of the margin contraction that we saw in our portfolio, where a lot of the companies that we were investing in were all saying the same thing, margin contraction. And it was quite disheartening to see that despite that we were investing in good companies, the margins were contracting and share prices were declining. So I'd say now, because we have companies which have lean operations and they have had the ability to absorb that cost inflation and pass through that pricing on to customers, we're now actually reporting a margin expansion average in our portfolio of 70 basis points of the Q1 quarterly results that we've seen. So I would say it's all about, well, not all about, but an important variable is to invest in companies which have the ability to pass through any cost inflation and have high margins.
Okie dokie. So I'm going to be cheeky now and public disclosure to what's already out there. A European company you found, or an AIM UK company you found that meets those margins, that's going to be able to push through to the customers that's doing well?
Yeah, so AB Dynamics is a company that I came across, we came across in the AIM portfolio and on the European strategy side. It's slightly too small for the European strategies just now, given our minimum market cap range of 500 million. However, that's a company which has a clear competitive advantage in its products and its services that it offers, particularly around simulation and brake testing. And that's an example of a company which is going to report margin expansion as well as a strong growth in earnings per share over the medium term, at least anyway.
Okay, now thank you for that response. Now, you've spoken about it already a little bit. You're a big advocate, and so is Aubrey, for growth at a reasonable price, GARP. Please can you expand on the importance of not overpaying for an investment?
Yeah, so I think overpaying for an investment, like, what does that mean? And that's one of the key questions that I actually learned to answer at Aubrey. Before I joined Aubrey, if someone asked me, is a company expensive or not, I wouldn't know how to answer it, whether I was looking at the PE or just in isolation. What does an expensive company mean? So at Aubrey, we always talk about relative valuation. So for example, if I told you a company was trading on a PE or a price to earnings multiple of 20 times, but it had an earnings per share growth of 10%, we would consider that to be expensive because we're looking for that peg. So if you did 20 divided by 10, that's a peg of 2. So for us, that valuation threshold is being breached. It's above 2 times. And the reason, by the way, we look for 1.5 times is because that if you're buying a company which is growing its earnings at 15% per annum and you hold it for a full business cycle, which is typically 7 years, you're going to see a return on investment of your 100% of your money, which is why we implement the 1.5 times peg. But anyway, so if someone said to me, okay, you've got this another company which is trading on 20 times PE, but it's growing its earnings per share at, say, 20%, well, all of a sudden now that to us looks attractive because it's trading on a peg of 1. So for us, it's all about relative valuation. So it's not about absolute PE, although absolute PE is important, but it's also about what is your price to earnings against? And typically for us, it's always earnings growth. But during the times, I mean, during the times where the markets were, we were operating in a zero interest rate environment, I remember looking at companies where we were trying to get into loss-making companies which were turning profitable the following year. So they were still growing their earnings above 15% on a 2-year average basis. But I remember sometimes we were valuing companies at a price to sales growth. I mean, it was absolutely like PE territory. It was like private equity kind of jargon. And I think that that's what I've learned in the going into 2022 is how quickly the environment can change. And all of a sudden, those valuation variables that we were once attributing to loss-making companies, you would never do that now because it's just not a favorable environment for those types of companies.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm seeing that all the while now with regards to, you know, the metrics for UK companies versus the UK companies. I'm going to touch on a bit later on. Jay, you've touched on this at the Master Investor Show as well. During times of market volatility and uncertainty, what is the best long-term investing strategy for investors?
I think during times of uncertainty and volatility, it's really important to invest in companies which can self-finance their earnings per share growth. And that's what we do at Aubrey. So, for example, you're not going to invest in companies which have to lever their balance sheets in order to achieve that earnings per share growth, because when the music stops and they don't have any more ability to bank finance their earnings per share growth, you're going to run into trouble. So I think during times of uncertainty, as long as you're investing in companies which have a healthy balance sheet, and what I mean by that is low debt, lots of cash in the balance sheet, that gives the cash aspect gives the company optionality. So it gives the company the ability to do buybacks, dividends, acquisitions, and reinvest into the company via CapEx. Having a company which has the ability to do all that, as well as being able to self-finance the earnings per share growth, you can't go far wrong. And if you're paying that at a reasonable price, despite short-term share price volatility, you should be in good stead.
Brilliant. I love that response. Now, I want to touch on something personal to yourself, Jay. I know that you are immersed and passionate about everything that Aubrey Capital does, but what do you do in your own personal investing? Do you just have all your eggs in the Aubrey basket, or do you do a little bit of on your own outside of the ISA?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. Typically, I do have money in the Aubrey funds for sure, but I find that I'm much more willing to take a risk when it's my own money. And typically, I don't know if it's a cognitive or an emotional bias I have, but sometimes I'm attracted to loss-making companies and I have been burnt every time. So I think in my own personal investing, I've learned the hard way of deviating from our investment philosophy and being burnt. But I now invest in companies, typically it's technology. So I have got a large position in my SIP and Tesla. I've bought positions in NVIDIA. I have a position in, trying to think off the top of my head, other good ASML. So I've got more of the semiconductor, BESI, BE Semiconductors. So I've got more of an exposure to those semiconductor names, I would say, in my own SIP. I wouldn't say that's necessarily the recommended approach, but it's if it's your own pension, it's your own money, and you're willing to take the risk for it. I mean, for me, I don't mind.
No, that makes perfect sense to me. I think the beauty of it is that it's commendable that you're saying I'm actually taking more risk, and you recognise it's more risk, and the strategy that you're extolling for everyone that should be taking lower risk, because you're young, much younger than everybody else that I know, is to go the way of the Aubrey Capital way, you know, which has been proven as a long-term winning strategy.
Yeah, exactly. I think at Aubrey as well, we have a risk management process in our portfolios where we never let a position weight above 5% of the fund. And I think, I mean, you probably remember the scandal with Wirecard, the German payment.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of some fund managers in the industry had that position in their portfolio well above 10%. And again, when that came crashing down, it really hurt, and it was a really painful, painful experience. And I think a lot of people got burnt. And at Aubrey, we had that 5% weight, which may hurt us on the upside, because a lot of the companies that we invest in are starting to they reach that 5% ceiling, and we have to take profit out of them. But it's more of a risk management tool, and I think that I don't do that in my own investments, but for anyone who does, maybe that should be a risk management protocol which they should implement.
You touched on Wirecard, and we've just seen what's been happening with the some of the US banks, you know, First Capital, yeah. Silicon Valley Bank, and even the mighty Credit Suisse. What's the Aubrey Capital process for triggering and selling and exiting a stock?
Yeah, for us, It comes down to two key variables in the sell discipline. Number one is valuation. So if a company's valuation is above that 1.5 times limit, we're not afraid to sell. And the second part to that is that if the company is not achieving that 15% earnings per share growth, we're out. And that allows us to keep our portfolios fresh and to make us constantly look for good ideas. I mean, that's the thing at Aubrey. We're not afraid to sell or take our love stocks out of the portfolio because they're not performing. We will do that, and we have done it. And it means that we do keep our portfolios fresh, and we're always looking for companies which can grow their earnings at 15%. And if there's one this year that's not doing it, and it might not do it the next year, like, for example, at a time where we invest in it, HelloFresh, just get rid of it and we look for the next one. We're always constantly looking for new ideas.
Brilliant. I mean, it appears to me also that the private equity companies are also looking for fresh ideas all the time. The only time most of the time I see a takeover going on at a premium, bearing in mind that private equity are always looking for bargains. We seem to be having a constant argument about our stocks, UK stocks, being undervalued, Jay, but the private equity companies are the ones that are coming buying. Why don't we put as much of a good valuation on our own stocks as fund managers, economists, you know, stakeholders in companies that are listed in the UK?
Yeah, it's really interesting you say that, because you've had THG, which has been a disaster of a listing. You've also had Deliveroo, which was a disaster of a listing. You had Made.com, that went bust. I mean, you had all these great companies in the UK, and yet they all seem to get bust. And I think it comes down to, generally, the UK's outlook on risk and the appetite for risk versus the US. And I think in the US, investors are much more forgiving of loss-making companies, or they're much more patient than they are in the UK. I think in the UK, arguably, I mean, this is just my opinion, we're maybe too short-term. We're maybe too focused on the quarterly numbers. We're too focused on, we want the profits now. We want the break-even point now. We want the free cash flow coming in. But in the US, I think they're okay to digest that, okay, we're going to have maybe 2 years of losses, but then the company should become self-sufficient in its earnings growth. So that would be my take on it. I'm not sure. Maybe just the UK investors aren't as willing to take a risk.
I agree with you. I think that is the case. And often we don't allow them to grow long-term. You know, we don't have something going from a tiny little acorn to a big tree. You know, Acorn became Arm, and what did we do? We sold it to SoftBank, and now we're still complaining about it not listing here. Silly, just silly.
I saw today in the Times that the UK government is going to invest $1 billion into to semiconductor chips in the UK. I mean, it's substantially below the US and other areas, but it's a start, right?
It's a start. We have to take the crumbs from the table we can get, mate. That's the essential. You know, $1 billion compared to $100 billion. It's just ridiculous, really. Yeah. Right, Jay. I want to talk about the balance side of it. That's important. The health side of it. Before I go to my final question, because I'm conscious I've had you on here for a little while. You're a former athlete, so you enjoy your CrossFit six times a week, and you also compete in competitions throughout the year. A, what is CrossFit? And why is it important for all investors, fund managers, and other people that are in this, the rigors of investing, to find something else outside of investing to keep themselves balanced and healthy?
Yeah. So for me, CrossFit is a functional fitness sport. It is a sport because you can compete in it, and it tests all elements of fitness. So what I mean by that, I mean, it tests your cardiovascular endurance, it tests your muscular endurance, it tests top-end strength, it tests gymnastics, it tests flexibility, coordination. You have to be totally engaged and focused when you're doing CrossFit. And the reason why I love it so much is because it's a complete distraction outside of work. When I'm doing CrossFit, it's the only thing where I'm totally focused on at that moment in time in the present is the CrossFit. And if I'm doing a competition, I'm only focused on doing my best in that competition. And I'm not thinking about balance sheets, earnings per share growth. I'm thinking purely about, I'm in a lot of pain right now. Let's get to the end. Hopefully I can survive.
No, that's I love that. I'll have to investigate it further. I'm more about mindful meditation at the moment,
Yeah,
and
but I mean,
occasional long walks, but yeah,
no,
I'll
but
have to
I
look
mean,
at that.
everyone has their different outlets. You know, if it is meditation or if it is going for a walk, then that's your way, and there's no right or wrong to it. That's your way. That's your way. For me, that my way is loud music, being in a hellhole. That's for me.
No, love that reply. Thank you ever so much, Jay. Now, it's been an absolute delight to have you on here, Jay, and learn a bit more about your investing and learn about you more as a person. But I want to end this particular interview with this question for you. And I get you, I sense you've almost answered this already. But I think this is a very important one for you to answer. With regards to your investment principles, what drives your passion to become the best fund manager that you can possibly be? Not only for yourself, but Aubrey Capital, but also for your clients. So I get the sense that you're right, absolutely on it.
Yeah, it's a good question. I just think it goes back to athletics, and I mean that where you can always surprise yourself at how good you can become. And I remember thinking when I was first doing athletics, I remember thinking, God, I'll never break 50 seconds for a 400, and then I did it. And then I remember thinking when I started my investment journey, going, God, I would love to get CFA, but I don't think I can do it. And then I got it. So for me, it's always just trying to push myself to the point where I surprise myself. And sometimes I look at a task and it is challenging, and it gives me that feeling in my stomach where I go, oh God, maybe I've bitten off more than I could chew here. But that's what motivates me, is to be able to put myself in those positions where I'm not afraid to take on responsibility, or I'm not afraid to make a decision. And if I do fall flat on my face, I'll hold my hands up and I'll do my best to learn, but I'm always constantly trying to push myself. As I say, me and my brother always call it, it's pushing our red line just one further, just being comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Brilliant. I absolutely love that response, mate. And I think I just know you're going to absolutely brilliantly going forward. And Sharon, I no doubt will be absolutely so proud of what you've done in the past 5 years. You know what I
I
mean? And
appreciate it.
what you're going to do in the next five as well.
I
And
appreciate
the
that.
Aubrey Capital team, I speak to John quite often, is absolutely so thrilled with you. So yeah,
I
kudos to you,
appreciate
mate,
that.
and long may your progress continue.
It means a lot, man. I appreciate it. And again, you know, thanks for having me on this, and I hope to see you soon. No doubt I will.
You will. I'll be down in London soon. Okay,
Amazing.
ladies and gentlemen, that was Jay Younger, the investment analyst from Aubrey Capital and the Aubrey Capital AIM portfolio manager. Jay, thank you ever so much. Take care. God bless you, sir.
Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to Investing Matters. Be sure to check out the London South East website for free tools and info to research your next investment. You can also join in the conversation on our social media channels. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more content, including our CEO interviews. Catch you next time.